Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 11, Text 1. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Sutta Uvacha. Anartansa Upavrajya. Sridhan Janapadan Sakan. Tadmau Saravaram Tesham. Vishadam Shamayam Iva. Sutta Goswami said, upon reaching the border of his most prosperous metropolis, known as the country of the Anartis, Dwarka, the Lord sounded his auspicious conch shell, heralding his arrival and apparently pacifying the dejection of the inhabitants. Purport. The beloved Lord was away from his own prosperous metropolis of Dwarka for a considerably long period because of the Battle of Kurukshetra, and thus all the inhabitants were overcome with melancholia due to the separation. When the Lord descends on the earth, his eternal associates also come with him, just as the entourage of the king accompanies him. Such associates of the Lord are eternally liberated souls, and they cannot bear the separation of the Lord even for a moment because of intense affection for the Lord. Thus the inhabitants of the city of Dwarka were in a mood of dejection and expected the arrival of the Lord at any moment. So the heralding sound of the auspicious conch shell was very encouraging, and apparently the sound pacified their dejection. They were still more aspirant to see the Lord among themselves, and all of them became alert to receive him in the befitting manner. These are the signs of spontaneous love of God. Om Jnana Tamarandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Taksurumulatam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Shri Caitanya Manobhishtam Apitam Yena Bhutale Kayam Rupa Kadamayam Sadati Sapadantitam Agadana Sinam Dante Vidam Yache Puna Puna Srimadrupa Padam Bhoja Yulisham Janma Janmini Vairagya Yudvakti Rasham Tiyatnai Apaya Mamana Bitsamandam Yipambuhiya Paradruka Dhuki Sanatana Sampagumatriyami Pancha Kalpa Sarup Yashcha Kripa Sindhu Bhaye Vrcha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadevor Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, greetings from the Sun Falls, where I have a small kutir for my work. Just finishing the last book, Japa Meditations, Contemplations on Entering the Holy Name, compiled and written by Ganadas Swami. Compiled because there are others that I've... this working, this one little more part the appendix from the proofreader, and then it's finished, and I'll start on my next book. But I have ideas for two different books, so we'll see how that works. So let's bring this into context. We're very fortunate through the Bhagavatam, and Prabhupada makes that very, very clear, that the Bhagavatam is Krishna, and the message is Krishna in sound vibration, and we get to associate with Krishna. And by reading about Krishna, we become attracted to Krishna, and especially in relationship to his devotees. Because in relationship to his intimate devotees, the intimate or beautiful side of God, which is Krishna, manifests. So we're watching Krishna and the relationship with his devotees, and we're seeing the beauty of Krishna, and we're seeing the beauty of an eternal relationship with him. Now he is entering Dwarka, and we ended with his departure from Hastinapur and the beautiful love and spontaneous sentiment of the residents there. Krishna was with them for a while, and now he's leaving. And in love, there's attachment to experience the love in that relationship, to serve one in that relationship, and to be with one in that relationship. That's natural. All three desires are there. I read this someplace. Three things. To experience the love, to be with the person personally, and also to serve that person. So when the person leaves as the object of attachment, there's a great want or separation. And Govinda Virahena Me. And the Shikshastakam, the higher stages of love, are described. In your absence, the whole world becomes vacant. This is the spiritual position. One is absorbed in the Supreme Absolute Reality and experiencing one's relationship. And in that relationship, when one feels that Krishna is gone, then naturally one feels empty or vacant or spiritually depressed. That's the symptom of love. Lasavai Saha, the spiritual realm, is moving on that principle. And that's the ultimate reality, this God exchanging with his potencies, which are to please him. In pleasing God, everyone becomes. That's the nature of love. You focus on the pleasure of someone else, but that is your pleasure. The one is also enjoying in love. So, the last few things we saw are these ladies on the roofs, and Krishna's going. And the attachment is extremely, extremely deep. Because it's the perfected relationship. It's the most real relationship. It is the eternal relationship. So we can only reference it by our experience in this world of some type of infatuation or some type of attachment to a dear one. And you magnify that. And Krishna is leaving, and the prayers, they begin to pray. Because outside of Vrindavan, even in intimate relationship, there's some cognizance or understanding of God's Aishwarya. That's part of the love. it's kind of this Aishwarya and Madhurya, there's the intimate love and then there's the reverential love. In Vrindavan, there is the pure intimate love which can never be covered by Aishwarya. Even when Aishwarya manifests, Mother Yasoda looks in Krishna's mouth and sees the universal form. She sees that, but it never changes her relationship. Where with Devaki and Vasudeva, they offer prayers, because that was their bhav, their mood. In their previous life, they wanted God as their son. So it's mixed with God, Aishwarya, and their son. That's their bhav. So they also have that sense of divinity sometimes. And then you can take that range to the Tapastis and the yogis who are meditating and have that mood of Shantaras. They're so cognizant of the potency and power of God that it's Shantaras. There's no Dasya. Dasya means service. There's no service. They cannot conceive of service because they see God in such a awe-inspiring way. All they can do is appreciate and pray. They can't have a conception that there's any service that's needed. Because they see his full self-sufficiency, his full omnipotency. Anyway, it's there, and in the Bhagavatam, for our own edification, we get these glimpses of Aishwarya also, and we especially, and I can't repeat that enough, we need that Aishwarya, because our intimate relationship with Krishna is not yet developed. And therefore, that gives us the sense of servitude, of a mood of service, which is the core mood in every relationship with Krishna. So the Bhagavatam always in the beginning, the story, or the history, it always mixes the two. It always gives us the intimate side, but then reminds us. So these prayers by these ladies, they're saying, look, that's God. He's here. He's not material. Do you remember from Hastinapur? You get a visual of what it must have been like on that roof to be with them and to see Krishna. He's here. He's not material because he existed before creation, and therefore he's not material, because he existed before there was even material was even existing. And that person, he can be seen by yogis, cognizant, to control their senses. And of course, yoga is the process to reveal the absolute reality. So, you control your senses, the super soul is at reach. Of course, you can be seen by the control of the senses. And of course, in devotional service, the control of the senses is not just to stop the senses, but to stop the selfish use of the senses. So this is devotional service. And they explain even the confidential literature by the confidential devotees. This confidential aspect of God, which is not revealed, just like the confidential aspect of any person is not revealed outside of those who have an intimate relationship with him, because others cannot comprehend that side of one. The intimate, it's not appropriate for others. Just like some of you have children, there's intimate sides of yourself that perhaps are not available to them. And there are intimate sides of yourself that are available to your children that are not available to those whom you work. So a person is always trying to reciprocate love, and there's various types of love that requires different revelations of one's heart. It's very, very simple. And that exists there in the absolute reality. And the fullest manifestation of God's heart is not available to everyone. It's not understood by everyone, but it's in the Shastra. And it's understood by the confidential devotees. And then that person, Krishna, who's standing before him, they begin to glorify Mathura, the land, just to show that that person is so special. That even though he appears to take birth like others take birth, then, but where he takes birth automatically becomes glorious because he's the origin of all creation. And then their prayers start to go into Dwarka, which is superior, as it's a more intimate revelation of God as Krishna smiles there. And his smile, his intimacy begins to become revealed. And it's so attractive. And to get to that position of a Dwarka Bhasi, where the intimate side of the absolute, the intimate and the most attractive side, a person is attractive by his loving nature. And God is attractive by his loving nature. And to achieve that, they say quite rightly, what type of penances one must perform? What type of austerities one must perform? Indicating it's such an achievement, even if it comes by grace. And then the Lord leaves, and the churning of the heart of those devotees begins. And Krishna, you know, he sees those prayers and he reciprocates by recognition, by a simple smile. If you revere someone, you value someone, you deeply love someone, you deeply respect someone, their reciprocation of your love, even if it's a simple smile, is the greatest treasure that you can own. Devotees, you may have seen these memory tapes with Prabhupada. How many would love just a simple smile from him, a recognition that I recognize your sincere service, I recognize your sincere love. And then Krishna leaves and Yudhisthira protects him. Of course, Krishna being the absolute reality doesn't need that protection, but he does need that protection because he requires or reciprocates with devotees' love, and according to that love, he manifests legitimate need to reciprocate with them. And they go a long distance with Krishna as he's leaving. They don't want to leave him. And Krishna, in such loving dealings, you see that with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also, when he leaves, Gadadhar Pandit goes with him. Even though Gadadhar Pandit made the vow of Kshetra Sannyas, there's a type of sannyasi, usually a sannyasi travels. That's one of his duties, parivrajatacharya. But some sannyasis can make a vow, I will never leave the Dham. Gadadhar Pandit made that vow, I'll never leave the Dham. But as he was going, Lord Chaitanya finally said, no, you have to return. And then obviously he fainted out of attachment and deep emotion. They were feeling profound separation. Srila Gaura Govinda Maharaj explained, in Krishna Lila there are three types of separations, which I've translated into my local vernacular, and therefore only those people who speak my language will understand it, as going, going, gone. Going, Krishna goes. He comes, and you know, we see that painting of Krishna on the chariot with Akrura, and the gopis grabbing the reins, fainting in front of the horses. So Krishna had not yet gone, but they were feeling separation. How deep, excuse me. Okay. Feelings of how deep that separation must have been. And then going, and then they continued, and then they saw Krishna go into the horizon, going, and then Krishna left God. And that separation, when someone whom you love is actually in the process of going, that's the deepest. And that's what these ladies and they were experiencing. And then Krishna travels to so many places on his way, and according to the Acharyas, he again fulfills his promise, comes back to Vrindavan, kills the demon Dantavakra. And then on the way he does rituals. And he does the rituals of household life. He stops on the way. He does his bhakti namaz, his prayers at different times of the day. And a very interesting commentary by Prabhupada on the difference between following and imitating. You should follow the great souls when they do things which are within your capacity to do. But you should not imitate them when they are performing things which are not in your capacity to do. Just like a great soul, he may go to Mangal Arati, he may preach, he may do so many things which are an example for you. But then that great soul may have intimate meditations on Srimati Radharani, which are beyond your capacity. So that you can't imitate. You follow what is in your capacity to do. And what to follow and what following will be imitation, that's determined by the Acharyas. So then Krishna now arrives, and that's where we are. Krishna's in Dwarka. And upon reaching the border here, he blows his conch shell. And and Rupa Goswami did this very brilliantly in his writings on Sanskrit poetics. Agratam is Rasa Shastra. So it's actually explaining and describing the highest type of love, which is rasa, which is when the affection for Krishna is heightened to the highest degree by appropriate actions and moods in that loving exchange. And it's very, very detailed. But those who know that can explain it. I know something here, vishadam, dejection. So they had dejection because Krishna had left. But what is that dejection? Vishada. It's a sentiment that's coming from their basic affection for Krishna in whatever relationship they have. So that dejection actually is born of their particular affection for Krishna and heightens that particular affection. So in the spiritual world, the only metaphor that can be given to us to help us explain something about the intensity of that love is like an ocean with waves. Sometimes waves will come from the ocean, and they will heighten the ocean. So that the ocean is our basic love for Krishna. But in the different exchanges in the spiritual world with Krishna, different emotions arise from those relationships, like waves. and sometimes one, two, three, four, five waves will come, heightening each wave of emotion. And sometimes the waves will clash. So it's considered like a churning of the spiritual heart. A churning of flavorful taste of deep, intense affection for God. And that's what the Bhagavatam here is explaining. So here, Krishna, he arrives. And Krishna, of course, is so beautiful, and they're in separation from him. And there's different types of separation from Krishna. One separation is you've seen Krishna, and then you're separated from Krishna. Another separation is you've never seen Krishna before, but you've just heard of Krishna. So here, they've had meeting with Krishna, and now they're separated from Krishna. And then Krishna's coming, and he reaches the border. And with great anticipation, the residents of Dwarka are waiting for his arrival to pacify the deep dejection. So that's already heightening their love. And then they hear the sound of Krishna's conch shell. And that's called udeeping. It's like if you throw a match into a fire. You throw a match into some fuel, the fuel of light. So that's also another analogy to help us understand. The fire, the match of the impetus comes, we'll see. So Krishna, they're already feeling deep dejection and separation from Krishna, who went away to participate in the battle of Kurukshetra. And there's great anticipation in their heart for Krishna. And then the conch shell is being blown. And they hear Krishna's arriving. This is similar. Every day when Krishna goes to the forest, there's always, I've explained this many times, like a river is flowing. That's another analogy. Like the love in the spiritual world, it's like a river. It's very forceful. If you see the heart is where the love is experienced somehow, and the love is like a river. So it's flowing through the heart. The stronger it flows through the heart, the more the heart is agitated by love. A very beautiful analogy is given to a river which has two embankments. When there's two strong embankments on the river flows most forcefully. So when there are two strong embankments on prema of separation and union, it flows very thickly and forcefully. So here we see when the residents of Vrindavan, they're with Krishna during the day, the night, and Krishna wakes up and he goes to the forest of Vrindavan, and they feel such intense separation from Krishna. And then at dawn, they wait for Krishna to come back, and the first thing they see is the Padaduli, because the sand of Vrindavan is like very fine powder. Sometimes if any of you were with me when we went to a Chakradham, when it was no electricity had even arrived in a Chakradham, I can't explain, communicate the sublimity of a Chakradham where Lord Nityananda appeared. If some of you were there with me, you could remember the sublimity of the place without electricity, and everyone in that whole village is absolutely blissful because they're not dealing with all the problems that we have. They just got to deal with the basic problems of life. Birth, death, disease, and old age. They don't have to deal with all the other complications of getting on the car, getting on the subway, the media and the disturbance and the internet and the complexities of life and the economic threat of what will happen to our country. And they're out in the village, there's no electricity. They just take care of cows and make cow dung patties and peacefully worship Lord Nityananda. And when you walk on that path, those you remember, the sand that they chuckle is like powder. So when Krishna is coming from the forest of Vrindavan, the cows are walking. Of course, Krishna's walking after the cows because he has so much attachment to the land of Vrindavan that he wants to pacify the land from the trampling of the cows. But the residents of Vrindavan, they see the padaduli, the sand, the clouds. And then, after they see the clouds, then they hear the beautiful lute playing of Krishna on the fifth note. And then they see his smiling face. So there was separation, there was union. They were with Krishna, he's gone, and this keeps the love flowing. So here these residents are experiencing this. Now this is practical in a way also. And the way it's practical is that we're encaged in a subtle and gross body that functions in a fruitive or selfish way. Basically, no matter what we do, it's mixed with that contention. And that's an unconstitutional nature. And it's a nature that's filled with duality. Because it's not real, that nature is not real, it's imposed, it's temporary, and therefore always threatened with non-existence. So that nature, it's based on a... So, what the process of bhakti means, and this was good, because when we discussed this, when we had that nice class in Amiyas on the... They had that nice class on Vedic psychology. When one accepts Guru and Krishna, when one surrenders and orientates his life for the pleasure of Krishna, there's a whole shift in his whole being. He starts to act. His vision changes. He tends to see his pleasures and his pains in relationship to the pleasure of Krishna. If pain is giving pleasure to Krishna, not that this is self-flagellation, but if some activity that you do, which you have to tolerate or causes some difficulty, some austerity, or you go through some trouble, then you accept that pain because that pain is in relation to the pleasure of Krishna. And if there's some pleasure which is displeasing to Krishna, like simple activity, subtle or gross, you give that up. Or if there's something that's pleasing to Krishna, then that pleasure that's pleasing to Krishna, then you accept that. It's a complete change in orientation. And if we can actually investigate within ourselves, we can actually be honest, if we introspect, that we'll see how much, even in spiritual life, we're so centered and focused, not on the pleasure of God, but on our own selfish pleasure. Even in service, what is our calculation? How will this promote me? How will this make me happy? How will this give me pleasure? So that shift in orientation, focused on the pleasure of God out of love, that's the beginning of bhakti or devotion. Sharanagata. That's the beginning. You surrender. You have faith in that principle. You have faith that that principle will lead to sublimity. Not selfish satisfying selfish desires will lead to sublimity. What will lead to sublimity is that consciousness. That I'm focused on the pleasure of Krishna, I'm focused on the pleasure of Guru. And I always marvel as I study Shastra and I come to simple realization, you know, how clearly Prabhupada outlined the core principles of self-realization. This is the core principle of self-realization for bhakti. This is the path of bhakti. And that's why it's the topmost yoga, because it's the it's antithetical to the consciousness that keeps us in bondage in this world, which is ahankara. So what the relevance here of this is, we're being introduced to the pure consciousness of the soul.
I'm here. Don't worry, my phone just fell. Be right back.
You can all hear me? Hi, Krishna?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay. So we're seeing that the pure consciousness of the soul. And the Bhagavatam creates the impetus for that pure consciousness. The impetus for the shift in consciousness. But it's based on surrender to Guru. And you can see how clearly Prabhupada outlined the principles, how clearly he taught that shift in orientation, and how he was actually able to communicate that. So here, Sita Goswami is explaining, so Krishna comes. So Uchakai se tavalo dara dara shuru kramasya tarashona shonima tadma yamana karakancha shampute yatabja kande kalahamsa utvana. The white and fat bold conch shell. So this is what they're seeing. Big white fat bold conch shell being gripped by the hands of Lord Krishna. He's got both hands on this conch shell as he's coming across the border, and sounded by him, appeared to be reddened by the touch of his transcendental lips. It seems that a white swan was playing in the stems of a red lotus. A white swan in the red lotus. But here it is, it's the conch shell, and Krishna's lips, which are red, is blowing it, and it creates the image that the conch shell has become reddened. And Prabhupada explains in the purport that this is spiritual life, the contact with Krishna. Krishnizes something. It makes it spiritual. And therefore, one who is Krishna conscious, everything around him becomes spiritual, because his consciousness has been reoriented for the pleasure of Krishna. So he sees everything for the pleasure of Krishna and uses everything for the pleasure of Krishna. And therefore, everything becomes spiritualized. Prabhupada mentions the Lord is present in every particle of existence, and he can manifest his presence in anyone. So this is the idea. Everything ultimately is conscious. It's just a question of how much that consciousness is covered. Matter is also conscious, but it's very, very much, the consciousness is very, very much covered. Because everything is ultimately part of God, who's conscious. Advayam Gyan. Non-dual consciousness. Everything else. So it comes out by spiritual contact. And Prabhupada said, by ardent love and devotional service to the Lord, or in other words, by spiritual contact with the Lord, everything becomes spiritually reddened, like the conch shell in the grip of the Lord. So everything becomes spiritual by the contact of Krishna. So the conch shell becomes tadiya. It becomes worshipable because it is used by the devotee. So this is the spiritual consciousness. You see everything if you're focused on that way, in a very practical way, you see everything in relationship to the Lord. Even the prescribed satisfaction of your attachments. Just like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Dharmo virudho bhuto shikamo spiva. I am sex life according to religious principles. So when it's used for procreation, you're using the appropriate way. So even the attachments, it's not renunciate philosophy, it's dedication. There's indulgement, there's renunciate, dedicate. Everything is dedicated. And one gives himself. And if there are attachments that one has that, according to his adhikari, are appropriate to use in Krishna's service, that also becomes reddened and spiritualized. And then Prabhupada also gives, this is also the image of the Paramahansa, a white swan playing in the stems of red lotus. The white swan and the red lotus, that's the swan who is separating the milk from the water. He's getting the essence, Saradrahi Vaishnava. He gets the supremely intelligent person. This is the intelligent person. He's in the world and he's extracting consciousness of God by his utilization of everything for God's service. It's a very practical spiritual philosophy. It starts with a cognizance of who you are on every platform. And then the purification begins as it's used for God's service. But here we're seeing the perfected souls. Are there any questions?
Mark?
Maharaj? Yes?
It's Mahamuni.
Someone else asked the question. Then I'll
I'm sorry. I didn't hear. I'm sorry.
Okay. That's okay. Wait. Who is that? Yes?
Maharaj.
Yes.
Maharaj, could you please clarify that you mentioned regarding that our pain can also give pleasure to the Lord?
It's not that our pain gives pleasure to the Lord, but we see things in relationship to the Lord. For example, in material consciousness, we reject pain if it's not giving us pleasure, right? Like, for example, if it's not connected somehow to our pleasure, either, whatever. Let me see if I just explain this. It's just an orientation in consciousness. It's how you look at things. Whether you look at things with yourself in the center or you look at things with God in the center. So if you look at things with God in the center, then when you have pain, in other words, when you have some pain or difficulty, your relationship with that will be in relationship to pleasure of God. So, for example, let's say that, you know, there was Vibhu Chaitanya, one great soul in Vrindavan, and he would wake up in the middle of the winter at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was so cold. He'd take a cold shower, and then he'd go down to the kitchen, and he'd work. So he looks at that pain as this is for the pleasure of God that I'm undergoing these difficulties, and therefore I accept it. Where if there was another type of orientation,
you would only accept that pain if it was for your own selfish pleasure. So it's a different orientation on that, and therefore you may reject it. If, hey, what does this have to do with me? This is too difficult. And we see that in our own life. How many times do we have to perform some austerity? And our thought process is this going to be good for me or not? Whether this is going to be good for the service of Guru and Krishna. You know, I'm seeing myself when I read these things, it's painful to me because I see how self-centered I am, even in spiritual life. How many of the calculations I make on what to do and what not to do, right, are based on not what is service to God and Krishna, but what is really good for me. Will I enjoy this? Should I do this austerity in devotional service? Because I will enjoy this. I will get pleasure out of this. Or do I do it because God will get pleasure out of this? And if your calculation is, will I get pleasure out of this, then if you're not getting pleasure out of it because it's too difficult, then you may not do it. Even if it's good for the service of Krishna. Even if it's good for the service of Guru. So it's a shift in consciousness. You're beginning to look at things as what pleases Krishna. And on that, let's put it this way, on that basis, you accept pleasure and pain, or you reject pleasure and pain. On that basis, what gives pleasure to Krishna? Rather than, I accept pleasure and pain, or I reject pleasure and pain, on what is good for me selfishly. It's a whole different orientation. And those who are very, very advanced, and I marvel at the lotus feet of not only my godbrothers, but so many great devotees I see in Prabhupada's mission who continually make decisions on what is good for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna, even if it brings them so much difficulty. Even if they'll undergo so much incredible difficulty, they'll make that decision that I will accept this difficulty because it's for the service and pleasure of Guru and Krishna. I marvel at them, I'm at their lotus feet. Because, and that orientation is purely of an advanced soul. He shifted the whole orientation. He's not working in the confines of the conditioned material mechanism of the subtle and gross body, which works for self-centered consideration. And that's why we're in that kshetra or material field, because of that consciousness. So it's shifted. Okay?
Thank you, Maharaj.
Mahamuni.
Maharaj?
Yeah.
Really, Maharaj, today's class was extremely inspiring. Thank you very much.
Well, we'll try it. Yeah.
My question is, you know, it struck me while I was listening to your discussion of Sharanagata and how it really is the core transformation that we go when we kind of begin our spiritual practice. It struck me that my experience with that practice as a young devotee was really just wholeheartedly giving myself over to the temple authorities and things like that. Yeah. And it was extremely powerful. I mean, my gosh, that's kind of what I think a lot of my initial spiritual experience manifest that gave me a lot of faith in Krishna and this process. So my question now is, one thing I see at this stage in my life where with kids and stuff like that and school and work, sometimes it's easy to feel like you're so caught up in the kind of machinery of the world around you and these various things that it's hard to feel like you have any avenue of control where you can exercise this kind of choice. Like, okay, now I'm going to give myself to Krishna, or now I'm going to try to change this part of my life. And so my question is, do you think it's a good idea to do things like just try to start to target like small little things and develop momentum or something? Like, you know, in some ways, there's real practical ways maybe to start these kind of transformative practices? And do you have any suggestions on them?
Yeah, wow, that's interesting. I would say also that when the orientation, when there's a shift in that orientation, then it's not dependent on ashram, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Then the focus is on everything you do. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean neglect the family either. You know what I'm saying? It becomes part of one's duty. You know, but you know, what parts of the duty he accepts and what parts he does, not what part of the duty he accepts, but what he does and what he doesn't do within that realm becomes very dictated by that consciousness. And, you know, sometimes I've seen, you know, there are people that are just in a karmic situation that, you know, they have very, very little scope to move. But that doesn't affect the consciousness. If that's the case, then even what that limited situation is within the realm of that consciousness, you know, because you're accepting it. You're accepting that situation for the service of Krishna, and then, you know, I can understand that, you know, it limits what we call sarup siddha bhakti, or, you know, the concentration on devotional activities that are, you know, not mixed with any sense of you know, fruitive or something. But in terms of what you're saying, the small little changes, I was thinking again of this paradigm, you know, of how we change our habits, et cetera, like that. You know, again, this may not be related, but I think we can continue the conversation after I say that. You know, I just thought that, you know, what vows do, you know what I'm saying? And like you say, little vows, right?
Mm.
What they do in those situations where, you know, you only have little spaces and you want to make sure that those spaces are really super transformative and not just kind of playing out your karma and kind of, you know, observing it and reacting to it in a spiritual way. You know, whatever it is, but you know, the spaces where you really want to, like, affect, you know, some kind of more deeply meditative, transformative spiritual practice. I thought the way vows works, and I've been observing this, is we have impressions in the subconscious for honesty and dharma to some extent, and what vows do is we play on that to keep ourselves in the conscious mind. I was seeing that recently with some vows, you know, that I've been making recently, right? And I was thinking, well, you know, normally I may not keep those things within my life, you know? Like, for example, going to bed at a certain time, you know, and then, anyways, things are not finished and you can keep on going at night, or, you know, someone calls or there's something to do, you know. And I say, why am I keeping it now, right? Because when you vow, right, you're calling on your impression in the consciousness for truthfulness. And if you vow, I will do this, then what happens is, you know, you vow, you verbalize, you commit, I will do this. Then what happens is, when the other impulses are carrying you away, which they normally would be, it becomes superseded by the impressions in the consciousness for truthfulness. You know, I have to keep my vow. And you see the whole thing in the Mahabharata and these other type of scriptures and things, it was all about developing that in people. Dharma, honesty, truthfulness, keeping to your word. You know, like Vasudeva, he kept to it. It was so strong in his consciousness. So when you develop at least that samskara, that nature for truthfulness, and you know, I will do what I say, you know, despite the difficulties, then once you bring that out of the consciousness by vows, that can supersede impulses that we have that take us away from spiritual life, providing that the impulse we're trying to restrain is within our capacity to do so. So, I don't know if I answered your question, but...
I think you did a lot. I mean, so it seems to me there's two things you emphasized. One is that in many ways we can reorient our attitude towards the world around us, and even that sort of can be a very deep act of bhakti, and the world can change. So in some ways I appreciated that, because it's much in line with things involving karma yoga that I've been trying to reflect on and practice in little ways.
Yeah, just explain that a little bit further.
Well, just the idea that it seems to me that you were suggesting that it's not so much a matter of always having to readjust the actual world we're in as much as readjust our attitude, and the attitude can be, you know, this is the arena that has given me in this time in my life. Let me just do my best to take these things that I'm in relation with and take these people and these circumstances and just try to find some way to connect it with service. Maybe sometimes it's as simple as changing our attitude and saying, Krishna's putting me in a situation to learn tolerance. But other times it may be very concrete, where it may be, like, for example, one's relationship with one's spouse. Let me now think, how can I help us both become more Krishna conscious, instead of how can I help us both become more comfortable or something. So I appreciate it.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So it seems to me that was kind of the first angle that you were saying. There's a way we can just reorient ourselves in relation to the world around us, where we don't necessarily escape our situations, but we transform our attitudes towards them into one where it can either support bhakti or actually be bhakti. Like
it seems there's a certain kind of destiny, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is beyond our control, right? And I think your point is that according to one's desires, according to one's deeds, right, one has made choices either in the past life or this life, which finds them in a particular situation. But there is a response to each situation that is for the pleasure of Krishna. And so it seems that we always have the chance to please Krishna. We just have to know what pleases him, jnana, and we have to have the ability to do it, vairagya.
Yeah.
But in any situation, there, you know, you make your orientation. It never says in Bhagavad Gita, you change your situation. The orientation is changed. Now for the pleasure of Krishna. Now that's going to change a lot in your life when you do that. Because there's certain things then within that situation that are not pleasing to Krishna, which you're going to not do. And there are certain things in that situation which you're not doing that you're going to accept because they're pleasing. So it does change the orientation. But you're right, the consciousness, or, hey, it's not going to have to change. I just have to change my attitude. That's also possible. You know, that, yeah, hey, you know, I'm married, so now how do I relate that it pleases Krishna? Okay, I have so many kids. Okay, how do I relate that it pleases Krishna? Now I have this job, and I have to work in the world, and it's undeniable. You know, how does this work that it pleases Krishna? And we saw in Bhagavad Gita, right, that the decision, I will give this up, may not please Krishna. You know, it may be a lack of surrender also, because it may be one's duty. It's like Arjuna. He thought, okay, you know, yeah, I know spiritual life. Now I have to, you know, please God. Okay, well, let me just go to the forest and do so. So we said, no, this is your duty. You know, you should just do it in a way that pleases Krishna.
And you're reminding me of something my guru said once about how devotees, sometimes they want to change the, like, service or something in the temple. But I think we can generalize to the fact that we often want to change our circumstances. And he said his response is, just do your best to be sure that you've done everything you can in your current circumstance, Krishna. And if still the obstacles are so great that you can't be Krishna conscious, you should trust that Krishna will change it for you. But spend your energy worrying about how to fully give yourself to your circumstances in a Krishna conscious way before you worry about changing the world to suit yourself. That was kind of interesting.
It's very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
And while you were explaining this, one thought in the back of my mind was that this part, this kind of idea, this kind of karma yoga way of saying it, it struck me that, sure, we change our attitude, but still changing our attitude isn't something you can do like, you know, it's not like taking a vitamin in the morning. It requires something. And that's why I really appreciated your second part, that there's something about just trying to apply little vows that can give us the strength to start to do this kind of radical transformation just because we're learning now to act in the realm of buddhi. And I really appreciated your point there, that there's a way that even little things can bring us to the level of the active mind buddhi, and that can give us the strength to start to make a lot of these conceptual readjustments. I think that twofold way of seeing it, one is kind of karma yoga, so to speak, and the other is trying to practice little vows that are available to us, are a really powerful way for people in the world to have this kind of transformative experience, it seemed to me anyway. So thank you. I mean, it was appreciated.
Yeah, the realization I also was trying to kind of discuss is, you know, in your subconscious, you may have a impulse, an irregularity that's not good for spiritual life, and then you have to do with it. Or you may have an impulse for eating that, you know, some people, you know, and now you're going to be advanced, but they just don't eat that much, you know. And some person has so now he's got to deal with that. I'm a devotee, and, you know, I just like to eat, and it's not, you know, I'm just eating too much and too wrong things, etc. So what I'm saying is, in the subconscious, he may not have that favorable samskara for, you know, regulating eating and sleeping, you know.
Uh-huh.
But he may have the impression for honesty and integrity. So I was trying to say what vows does is take that in that in part of one's nature and bring it to the forefront. Like you make a vow about eating, right? Like, for example, Zakatase, I may not eat anything. Now my impulse, right, is to eat, you know? But now I'm not going to eat. Well, why I'm not going to eat? Usually, I have a good appetite, you know. You know, so, that day I won't eat. But what? Why? Because I've made a vow, and I have integrity, and I'm going to keep that vow. So that part of my nature on that day becomes prominent. Anyway, okay. Thanks, Moody.
Thanks so much, Moody.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, would anyone like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Kumar from New Mexico.
Kumar, Hare Krishna, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Today and Wednesday. Thank you. Kumar is a dentist in, I believe, it's a Navajo reservation. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Shastra.
Jai Maharaj.
Hare Bo. Great to hear you. We're going to be doing, I'm probably going to do in New York City, but I don't know how I'm going to do it, because midnight I'm going to be in New York City probably. I have to speak to Kasuba, but I'm very, very determined to, by the next day, be in Delaware, if possible, because Chaitanya Maharaj, Satyut Maharaj, and Gunadhar Maharaj are going to be there for Prabhupada's Vyas Puja, and that'll be great opportunity for me to get the association of people who are some of them senior most devotees who had so much personal association with Prabhupada. So Shastra, we can, I know most people won't be in the area, but we can extend an invitation, right?
Yes, we'd love to have you.
Okay. Okay, if anybody wants to go to Delaware, just give me or Shastra and we'll give you the directions how to get there. Just be, I'm looking for a place where I get that kind of sangha. Very good. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj, it's Paramananda.
Paramananda, Hare Krishna.
Hare Gopal, thanks for the class.
I'm sure you enjoyed it.
I did.
Yeah, great. Okay, thanks for coming on. Very good. Good. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna? Actually, it's kind of interesting in the summer. It's really, really hard to figure it out, but well, I guess, I don't know, this summer the numbers go down. People do traveling and so many things, so there's not as many people as usually, Ron.
Hare Krishna, okay. Hare Krishna.
That's Mother Indrani?
Yes. I want to thank you so much for this class today. Krishna knows what one needs to hear when one is trying to help oneself and others, and you brought out some wonderful points. I pray that I can pass them on and use them myself. This was really, really great today, I tell you.
Wow, great. So nice to hear from you, Mother and Johnny. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my love.
Anyone else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. This is Dr. Carl.
Carl, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for the class. I thought it was an especially cogent class today.
Really good.
Together and helped, you know, helped together and moved along. It was great. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. It's I'm on stage every week, you know, so and I got to come up with a new show, you know.
You know, disappoint, Maharaj. You know, disappoint.
Well, I'm into something, you know, this Vedic psychology thing and how that works is such an interesting paradigm that applies to so many things. In fact, I had this idea to maybe kind of write a Bhagavad Gita kind of commentary based on this paradigm, you know, showing how everything that's instructed, how it fits into the purification of the mind. I'll try.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Who's that?
Gordon.
Hey, Gordon. Hare Krishna. We'll see you. You're going to come on the 10th, right?
Yeah.
We're going to do a program up in Millbrook. So I'm looking forward to that. Thanks, Gordon. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, we'll end for today. Thank you all so much. Vanshakalpa Trujya Shakita Sindhu Bayeva Chakra Pitam Pavan Vidachi.